In this part of Focus 580, we will revisit a topic that was in the news quite a lot a few months ago, and that is stem cells and stem cell research. I think that we felt that even though it was getting a lot of coverage in the media, that there were still significant numbers of people who had some very basic questions and weren't really sure what it was that we were talking about here. And we thought it would be useful to do a basic kind of show and try to answer those questions. And that is what we will be doing in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Robert Cranston. He's a neurologist at Carle Clinic in Urbana. He's been good enough to come over and spend some time with us. It sounds like he's struggling with a little bit of a cold, so we're hoping that he will survive the experience of being here and spending the hour talking with us. Of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, we appreciate you being here with us very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I guess the most basic question, the place to start out, is with the question, what are stem cells?
Well, stem cells are cells that are naturally occurring at different places in the body, and they can give rise to a number of different types of specialized cells throughout the body. For instance, right now in the bone marrow, many of us have thousands and thousands of stem cells, but we're discovering that they're actually present many other places in the human body as well.
So, and I, here I guess where it gets, may get sort of confusing and gets at some of the controversy about stem cells is that there are different possibilities for getting stem cells. There are embryonic stem cells, and that's where the controversy is, where there's a lot of controversy. And then there also, so in embryos there are stem cells, but also in adult human beings there are stem cells, and also it's possible to get stem cells from the blood that's in the umbilical cord,
correct,
right, and
yes,
also from placenta,
correct,
as well. So what's the difference between the kind of stem cells you could get from an embryo and these other sources, and the kind of stem cells that you and I have?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it raises a number of other questions. Veterinarians and oncologists have been doing work with stem cells for many, many years. In fact, adult stem cells have been used to fight a number of different kinds of tumors throughout the body, and lymphoma and other things. Stem cells in veterinary science have been studied for, I believe, over 25 years. And those are available, and they're isolatable and culturable, and they have many functions. The new twist came in 1998 when there was a team at Wisconsin headed by Dr. James Thompson, who did his work on stem cells obtained from embryos from fertility clinics, and a Dr. John Gearhart at Johns Hopkins, who got his stem cells from aborted fetal tissue. The big differences so far, we believe that the stem cells obtained from embryos might be more versatile and they might last longer. On the flip side, some people believe that the stem cells obtained from adults are obtained without the moral questions involved with the other stem cells, and in fact might be less prone to have a tendency to turn into bad things. An example there would be that some of the embryonic stem cells, when they have been used, have actually turned into tumors in the new host.
So, again, and here, you know, the way I understand it is that some people would say the advantage of the embryonic stem cell is that you're getting the stem cells at the point where these cells could develop into anything, into any. So theoretically, the idea is that you could take something like that and say you decided you wanted to grow some kidneys for people who didn't need them, because we don't have enough to meet the need. Here you could have a cell that, if you knew how to do it, you could say to that cell, I want you to become a kidney. And theoretically, it could do that.
Right. You're correct. It needs a little amplification, though. Okay. The amplification would be that the change into an actual organ is probably going to take a number of years, perhaps even decades. To get them to go into specific cell types of those organs will happen much sooner. It also needs a clarification because historically there was the feeling that adult stem cells could do none of that, that they were stuck just being one type of cell. But in the last 2 years, a number of investigators, particularly a large group at the University of Washington, have shown that adult stem cells are amazingly plastic and can become many different types of tissues.
So that's my understanding that some people would say if there's an advantage in the embryonic cell stem cells is we know that they could become any other kind of cell. That limitation when we're talking about adult stem cells is while they may have the capacity to become some number of other cells, we don't think that an adult stem cell could become any other cell. Is that correct?
Yes, I would agree basically with what you've said, except that I would again say we believe, we think, we surmise, we postulate. At this point, that's really where we are in most things. As far as this whole debate goes, we don't really know that those embryonic stem cells can become all the wonderful things we think they will, and we also don't know that the adult stem cells cannot become those things.
Mm. We have a lot of very wide open questions yet.
That, absolutely.
And when you take a look at the research that has been done, obviously there's research being done on both kinds. Within the field, is there still some sort of feeling that one or the other has more potential, or is it somewhat divided between people who've decided they want to go one way and people who decided they want to go another way?
Well, obviously, if your lab has already received funding for moving in one direction, that's what you would want to encourage. A number of scientists believe that we should go forward with both because they both offer different promises. The main objection on a moral basis is that to get the stem cells from the embryo has to be destroyed. So you actually do kill this blastocyst stage embryo. And, of course, that's where the Roman Catholic Church would take a stand against that. They would say, this is a new life and we don't want to kill that.
Mm. And that's, again, that's to for people to understand, that's really the source of the controversy. That is the fact that the source for embryonic stem cells are indeed embryos that have been manufactured for use for helping couples who are infertile to be used in vitro fertilization. What they do is they take some sperm, they take some eggs, they put them together, and they get a number of embryos. They may then select one or two or some number for implantation, but then assuming that that goes successfully and these folks have their children, then there are leftover embryos. And assuming that the couples give their consent, there's no payment made, then and I don't know who it is that's made this decision, then they'd said, okay, you can then take these embryos and you can use them as a source of stem cells. And as you say, some people say who believe that that is a potential human being said, no, you can't do that. And so that's where we are with that.
What you've just said is pretty much true. But what you've described is the work going on at Wisconsin. And they are there using excess zygotes. The work that took place at Johns Hopkins was actually using the germ cells from abortuses. So those weren't from zygotes, but those were actually from aborted fetuses.
So they're just another layer of controversy and concern for some people.
Right.
I'm curious now. I don't guess I'd never really thought about it. I don't know. Probably very many people haven't. What have we been doing in fertility clinics? What have we been doing with leftover embryos? Do they just keep them forever? What do they do with them?
Well, maybe we should even back up and say, ask the question, why are there leftover embryos? And to answer that question, the whole issue of preserving a woman's egg is a technological problem. So far, if you try to preserve an unfertilized egg and then thaw it later, the rate at which those can actually live is almost nil. On the other hand, if you fertilize those eggs and then you thaw them out later, a reasonable percentage of them do live. Since that is the case, and since capturing the egg from a fertile young woman is not an easy process, one has to give her medications, and then one has to do a minor surgery to actually capture those eggs, the decision has been made to capture excess eggs. And then, since they would be destroyed if they were frozen without fertilization, they then go ahead and fertilize them. What happens then is that they usually insert several of those fertilized eggs into a woman's uterus during any given cycle when they hope to conceive. And the rationale there is that, unfortunately, again, there's a significant attrition at the level of thawing to actual implantation. In some women, several of those eggs do go ahead and implant, and that's why you can have multiple pregnancies. But in a lot of women, only one of those eggs comes to implantation. After the couple has as many children as they want, though, for many of those couples, there will be excess fertilized eggs or zygotes left over. The question then becomes, do they want to keep them around for future reference? For instance, if the children were to die or something, if the children were to have a major illness, or do they give them away to other people who might actually adopt those zygotes and implant them in another woman? And that is a process that's being done in California, even as we speak. Or do they just leave them in the freezer for future reference? And one of the issues on leaving them in the freezer for future reference is that thus far, we have good reason to believe that there's a limited freezer life. That if they're in the freezer for more than 5 to 7 years, that they probably can no longer become implanted or become babies.
Mm. And is this something that is a decision that's left up to the parents? Is it something that different fertility clinics have different policies on this?
Yeah, there actually are some fertility clinics that have a long discussion about this up front and make the point that they're only going to take enough eggs to actually be fertilized and be implanted. But that's not the policy very many places. The vast majority of clinics would take, 10 or 12 eggs at any given time. And then the eventual disposition of those zygotes would depend upon several things. It would depend upon the continued payment of rent by the family. For instance, if they no longer paid the upkeep on the freezer, then it would be the right of the people who own the freezer to say, we're getting rid of these eggs.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Robert Cranston, he's a neurologist at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And we were talking about, talking about stem cells and some of the research that's going on here in the United States on stem cells, the possibilities of using them to develop medical treatments and some of the issues raised. And questions are welcome if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are. The number is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You match up the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL, so 333-WILL, and also toll-free, 800-222-WILL. In addition to the fact that Dr. Cranston is a neurologist, we shall also mention he is also a bioethicist at Carl Clinic and has a master's degree in bioethics. So he's not primarily as a neurologist, but as a bioethicist. And questions are welcome.
Actually, as a neurologist, I would say I have a vested interest in this whole conversation because many of my patients suffer from the very diseases that we're discussing. Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, stroke, quadriplegia from cord injury, ALS.
The last time that there was news about stem cells was when President Bush made his announcement about the fact that some federal funding for stem cell research would be allowed to go forward. The funding that had been going on now in the past, has that been all private funded research? Has there been any public funding for stem cell research? Or maybe we should say for embryonic stem cell research?
Well, that's a very interesting and complicated discussion, because historically Congress had put a ban on any embryonic research. During the last few years of the Clinton administration, a loophole had basically begun being used by researchers. And that was the loophole that as long as the embryos were obtained with no direct connection to different abortion clinics, then they were then used. Now, many people felt that that was not a correct interpretation of the law, but at the time, that was kind of a loophole, and Clinton seemed okay with that. Then when President Bush came into office, he immediately clarified that that wasn't okay. So then that brought the whole argument to a big head this last August, where the statement was made.
Well, but again, had the funding come from, and was it still primarily private funding, or had there been some federal funds involved?
Well, my understanding is that while much of it was private, there was some federal funding involved, yes. I could be mistaken on that, but that's my understanding.
Okay. And what the president said was that for existing lines of stem cells, and we probably should go on to talk about what exactly that means, but essentially what he said, everything that had happened up till now, stem cells that had been obtained and work had been done up till now, up till that point where he made the announcement, he would say, okay, on that we can go forward with funding, essentially saying, well, what's been done is done, we can't undo that, but that then no federal funding could go towards working on new lines of cells.
Correct. I think the line that he was drawing in the sand was that he didn't want to further destroy any embryos that had not already been destroyed. Hmm. Of course, that's somewhat of a pragmatic line to draw in the sand, and it doesn't necessarily follow principle real well. And many people in the Catholic community, for instance, were unhappy with that decision, as well as some people in the very conservative evangelical community as well. Mm-hmm. Others felt that while they weren't completely happy with it, they were glad that no more embryos were going to be destroyed. And then, of course, on the other end of the spectrum were people that found no moral problem at all with destructive embryo research, who felt that this was a major problem now.
Mm-hmm. In an embryo, say we have an embryo, it's my understanding that we could have something between 50 and 100 stem cells in one embryo.
When the egg and the sperm join together, they immediately begin dividing. And embryologists have given those early days different names. For instance, they call one cell, one level, a morula. And a few days later, on about day 10, they talk about a blastocyst. A blastocyst probably, just off the top of my head, has several hundred cells in it. Mm-hmm. And that is what is usually taken, the inner cell mass from the blastocyst is taken. So at that point, you're probably talking over 100 stem cells.
Okay. And so then what researchers are doing then is that they are selecting, say, one cell and then causing that to produce more cells?
Well, this is the tough part, and this is the high science part, and it's done in the lab, and some of this is published in the literature, and some of it is probably kept under close wraps in the individual labs where they're doing it. But the transition from getting that 100 cells from the blastocyst and actually turning them into tissue is where all the high science is. That's the tough part. And they try to use all of the cells and culture them up and see what they can get out of it at that point.
So it's not just I guess what I'm trying to understand, make sure that people understand, is if, so say you have an embryo and it's got 100 cells, that then that embryo is not just for you going to be the source of 100 cells, but that the idea is that you could take perhaps those 100 cells and then use them to produce other cells so that you would have something that would, in a sense, perpetuate itself.
Yeah, that's the beauty of stem cells. And in fact, that's the, even in adult stem cell research that they've already done, they've been able to do that very type of thing. In one mouse model, they transplanted one stem cell and repopulated the entire bone marrow from one stem cell. So yeah, that's why, even though there are only 60 lines, the president former Governor Thompson, I'm blanking on his name, Tommy Thompson is saying that even though there are only 60 lines, they think there will be enough cells.
Yeah. Well, and that also is a point where apparently there has been either some confusion and or some controversy, because after the president announced his decisions and made that very point, that said, well, we've got plenty of cell lines going now and that should certainly be enough to draw on, then some people said, well, we're not really sure that there are that many cell lines. Do we actually know how many there are, and why is it that should be a difficult question to answer?
Well, one reason it's a very difficult question to answer is some labs may have them and have not made it known. Other labs have cell lines, but they're not sure they're going to turn out to be useful. And a number of the 60 are probably in that second category, that they have the early stem cell lines going, but they're not sure that they're going to pan out, and they're not sure that they're going to be a reproducible line.
We're just about at our midpoint here, and maybe I should just take a second to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Dr. Robert Cranston. He's a neurologist and bioethicist at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and we're talking about stem cells and stem cell research. This was a subject that got a lot of coverage in the news media not very long ago, a few months ago. And at that time, we started thinking that, as I said at the beginning, even though it had gotten a lot of coverage, we felt that there were probably a lot of people who still had lacked a good basic understanding about what exactly it was that physicians and researchers were doing and what they thought that then they would be able to do with these stem cells. So we thought it would be a good idea to basic kind of conversation about that. And questions are welcome if you want to call in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and also toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, let me again go back and ask a real basic question, because we talked a little bit earlier about, it was again sort of my understanding that this idea was that the embryonic stem cells had the potential, some people felt that they had the potential to be more useful because they had the potential, each of these cells had the potential to develop any other kind of cell. And the thinking is, again, we don't know exactly, but the thinking is that as we get older and our stem cells get older, they may be less flexible. They don't have that complete level of flexibility. But it sounds as if, though, that even though some people say that the embryonic stem cells are totipotential. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Meaning that they have the potential to develop into any other cell. It sounds like, in point of fact, we're either not quite sure whether that's true or that may be true, but we don't know how it is to get them to do that.
Yeah, I would say it's almost certainly true. I mean, that embryonic stem cells are totipotential. But how to actually make them change then into the type of cells that you want them to be becomes a big issue. Yeah.
And that also here we're talking about work that is going on in laboratories where they are hoping, I'm sure they're hoping eventually to be able to have a marketable product and make money. So that might must also make it a matter. There are things that they must consider proprietary issues and may be, in some cases, reluctant to talk about what it is they're doing.
Absolutely. The transition from getting the inner cell mass from the embryo and getting it into tissue, that really is where the high technical science is. And, of course, some of that is showing up in the medical literature. Mm. But there definitely is the potential to make trillions of dollars. And so it isn't all leaking out instantly to everyone who might find that helpful.
Even I'm sure probably even people who are doing research are maybe reluctant to talk about it with each other.
Yeah, I imagine that's true. I would hasten to say I'm not doing that kind of embryonic research myself, and so this is only surmise at that
right.
point.
Oh, but sure. Well, we have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that? They're in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could comment on how the stem cells in the cord blood compared to those from an embryo or from an adult? Are they considered to be somewhere in between as far as their potential? And because that would also seem to be a non-controversial potential source of stem cells for research. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, good question.
That's a very good question. Cord blood and also placental stem cells. The NIH official position statement, and I would certainly encourage those of you who want more information after this talk, to go to the NIH website on stem cells. The NIH position paper actually does talk about the fact that these are probably somewhere in between. They are probably more pluripotential, which is kind of that in-between stage, than the adult stem cells. And, of course, there's virtually an unlimited supply with placentas and with cord blood. You know, how many new children are born every day in this country, and we could certainly use that as a potential site. And I agree with you, it would certainly have no significant ethical overtones.
Have there been therapeutic applications of stem cells done to date?
Well, there have been a number of interesting things done in mice. To my knowledge, and I could have a caller correct me on this, but to my knowledge, there haven't been any significant direct applications to humans that have been beneficial. This question was raised in the recent CAS colloquium on campus at Smith Hall, and at that point, when there were 10 panelists up on the stage, one of the panelists said that he thought it would probably be decades before there was significant clinical utility.
Mm. Well, that's, again, one of these things where something new comes along and it gets a lot of attention in the media because it's exciting and may indeed have great potential benefits. And I'm not sure if in the reporting, we're always, in the media, we're always very good about qualifying the stories that we do, at least to let people know that this kind of research is in the very early stages and that indeed it could be a long time before there would be treatments for a disease, for example, based on this kind of work.
Yeah, that's true. The numbers are all across the board, though. I've heard other people say that potential benefits might be as close as 3 or 4 years down the road. So, you know, I really can't say on that. It might be 3 to 5 years. It might be 15 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Is there any, if one looks at areas where we think that that promise might be there the soonest. I mean, is there anything that stands out as being, when we talk about, when we rank things in order of difficulty and complexity that we might think that we would want to do, are there particular areas that are higher up on the list that is less complicated than some other things that we might think we would want to do?
Yeah, I think the whole area of diabetes type 1 is an area that we may see sooner advances than other areas. Because in a mouse model already, they have taken some of the cells from the pancreas and have actually been able to stimulate islet cell growth, which when transplanted did help cure the mouse model for diabetes type 1. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that will drive research, I'm sure, is the frequency of the illness. And, of course, diabetes type 1 is very, very common in this country.
We have another person to talk with. This person on a cell phone here on our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
I hesitated to call in until I heard your answer to the last caller. And I don't know, you may not want to go here, but I'm going to ask anyway and then hang up and listen. I was baptized in the cradle as a Catholic, and all my life I've been taught that life begins at conception. And a lot of things about being a Catholic have, I've questioned, but that particular thing as an adult has stuck with me, and I think that the reason it has is because as I understand the science of reproduction, when the egg and the sperm meet, the DNA code is written at that point. And that then at that point you have a human being like no other human being. And that if these stem cells, which can be used to potentially be used for all these wonderful things, which I agree are, it's worth pursuing in the field of science. I'm wondering, as a bioethicist, for you must not agree with me that life begins at conception, and I'm wondering when it does begin. And I'm going to understand, maybe that's too personal a question, but I think it's primary to the ethical conversation here. So I'm going to hang up and listen to what you have to say. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Actually, I think that's an excellent question, and it gets to the very heart of the whole controversy. Bioethicists come from a number of disciplines, and religion is actually one of the disciplines that has birthed bioethics, along with medicine and law and science and social work. You would actually be incorrect in assuming that I disagree with you. My personal position on this is that life does begin at conception, and because I believe that, I am a strong advocate of placenta and cord blood and adult cell research. I personally was not completely happy with the president's decision, but I could see it as being some type of reasonable compromise. Now, having said that, you raised an issue, and that is, when do people say that life begins? Well, many of us do believe that it begins when you have 46 chromosomes, and that's where I would go. Other people draw it at 6 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks, depending upon different types of changes that are occurring in the fetus. Some religions draw it at the time of quickening, which is an old term, but for most people it means when the mother can feel the baby kicking. In the Middle Ages, they talked about a concept called ensoulment, and they actually had different time frames depending upon if you were a little girl baby or a little boy baby. Peter Singer, who is the an endowed chair philosophy professor at Princeton, believes that personhood does not occur till well after birth. He would actually go so far as to saying that personhood doesn't begin till at least a year, perhaps several years. And consequently, even though he's a famous philosophy professor, he would see infanticide as being morally correct. So you can see bioethicists end up in a number of different places on the spectrum, and I would definitely be on the more conservative end.
But again, I think, again, for and perhaps people weren't listening to the beginning part of the discussion, we probably should point out again that there are, as you've explained, different sources for stem cells.
Right.
There are the embryonic stem cells, but there are also some that are available from the blood in the umbilical cord, from the placenta, and human adults also have them. And that, so there, for people who would want to do stem cell research, there are sources of stem cells that get around the very problem that the caller raises. So that if that's a concern, there's a way to address that concern. And that it still also seems to be an open question whether some people would have – I know some people would have argued in the past that the embryonic stem cells were better because they had the potential to develop in a wider range of other cells. But as you've explained and as I understand, is that that's still something of an open question. We just – this research is in such early days that we really don't know whether, in fact, they – have the potential we would think, or that adult stem cells would be limited in the ways that we would think. It's still something of an open question.
Yeah, absolutely. At the colloquium that I mentioned to you that was held at Smith Hall not too long ago, a questioner from the audience basically asked the question, do we know that embryonic stem cells are really a better source for this research? And the answer is no, we don't know that. It may well turn out that adult cells or placenta cells or umbilical cells are better. So that does become very key at the heart of the controversy.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Robert Cranston. He's a neurologist and bioethicist at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and we appreciate his being here. I know he's uncomfortable because he's got a bad cold, and I appreciate your struggling through.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Let's go back to the phones here. We have a caller in Champaign County, line number 4. Hello.
Right. I guess I have a technical question and then a resource for people like the caller and maybe even the ethicist to look at. The question is, after the research has been perhaps fully developed, it's conceivable that they may get good enough at manipulating these things and making them versatile so that they may not have to go back. And what I'm suggesting is there might be enough lines. It isn't like you would have to necessarily go to a close relative. That's the premise, is that it's possible that it could go, the research could go that way. I guess that's probably what you would be hoping for, too. Now, I support it, I think, and even if it isn't the case. The resource I wanted to mention, and I think I've mentioned it on the air before and suggest that these two guys, or at least one of them, to be on the radio. The U of I Press actually published a book called A Brief Liberal Catholic Defense of Abortion, and it goes through the rather peculiar history of how Aquinas and early sort of medieval Catholics, believed in something called the quickening, and that they didn't believe in soul and happened. You did mention that, but this is a resource that actually goes through the sort of the development of the philosophy, and it actually makes the case that it was sort of 17th century scientism that changed the Vatican's opinion on this. There was the belief that the embryo was a fully developed homunculus. I forget how that's said.
Homunculus.
Homunculus. And I think it's really well reasoned, and it's an interesting antidote to this idea that ensoulment is at the moment of conception or when the chromosomes count 46 and that sort of thing. But I don't know how you'll handle that. But I really do recommend these people for an interview because it's not an often heard discussion. And the other thing is just we don't know what the potential of the research is, but it seems that one of the problems with some of the cell lines, I understand, is that they're grown on a sort of a mouse substrate, so that obviously they don't have it down as for how to propagate these without relying on something like that, which might be a huge contaminant. I'll hang up and listen, and maybe there's another call or two. Thanks.
All right.
I appreciate your question. I'm not sure I followed it all. I know that the basic issue on when you decide this person is a person is right at the crux of the problem. And I know that even within the Catholic Church, there are Catholics of different persuasions. The basic position that personhood begins at the time of 46 chromosomes is, as I understand it, the official position of the Vatican. So I'm certainly not speaking for all Catholics. In response to your other point on the fact that some of these are mixed with mice stem cells and a mice matrix, that's absolutely true. Some of them are, and that the science of getting them separated and not giving the humans that would receive these some type of illness related to the mouse is a major concern.
Well, just also to pick up on another point I think the caller touched on that we haven't mentioned, it comes under the heading of potential benefits, particularly when we're talking here about adult, if we can understand how to use adult stem cells. And the idea is here that since all adults have them, I mean, we all have them, that if we could figure out how to do it, we could actually take, if you wanted to do a therapy, you could take some of an individual's own stem cells. And then no matter what you do, whether you were going to take them and in some way put them back into the body, then that individual's body would recognize those stem cells and would say, hey, those are mine, so that you wouldn't have the kind of problems with rejection that you do with, for example, with organ transplantation.
Absolutely. That's one of the most important driving arguments, aside from the moral ethical dilemma, for use of adult stem cells is the lack of immune compromise or immune incompatibility. Right now, we can get stem cells from fat, brain, bone marrow, lung, liver, pancreas, breast, tooth pulp. And as you mentioned, some of those can be taken out of the body, perhaps, and cultured and given back. And another perhaps exploding area would be if we could leave them in the person but somehow trigger them so that they did what they're supposed to do without ever having taken them out of the person at all. That would be ideal.
Yeah. And then to the other question, and I guess this again remains an open question within people in the field of research, that is this question is the number of existing stem cell lines that we have. I mean, if we decided for ethical reasons we didn't want to do any more work involving embryos and we just said, okay, what we've got now is what we're going to work with, is that enough?
Yeah, and the answer to that is we don't really know. There are some very good people, in fact, some people at the University of Wisconsin who were on the forefront of doing this right from the start, who have said that they believe that there are enough stem cells coming out of their own lab to do everything. And then there are well-intentioned, honorable people in the embryo research camp who would argue, and they'd say, we don't know. We don't know how many of these are going to pan out. We don't know how long they'll live. So that is, you know, again, one of the major turning points in the whole debate.
And this, again, this the debate that we've been talking about concerning funding, federal funding for research on embryonic stem cells. If one wanted to do research on embryonic stem cells and you had money, you had private money, there would be nothing preventing you from doing that, right?
Well, right now, that very type of research is going on in Sweden and in a number of European countries and in India. And it could be done in several states. It can't be done in every single state because right now some states already have laws on the book about embryonic research. On the other hand, if you know, you could go to a small island off the coast of Florida and, it would be an easy thing to do, really.
So assuming that there's no laws that say you can't do that, it could be done. And indeed, as you say, there are people who obviously believe that there's money to be made if they could figure out how to develop therapeutic applications for what the things we've been talking about.
Actually, there is potentially, you know, quadrillions of dollars to be made if it works out. And more importantly, there are a lot of lives that can be helped and a lot of people that can benefit if appropriate research goes forward.
Yeah. Well, we've got a couple of minutes left. We have mentioned a couple of possible applications, one that you mentioned as being fairly high on the list when we look at things that where we think it's maybe less difficult than more difficult would be in diabetes. But there have been another number of other things discussed, applications, I guess everything from Parkinson's to heart disease, and also the possibility of those conditions where what we've got is organs that just aren't functioning right. What are the various, when people think about what might be done, what are some of the things that are on the list?
Multiple sclerosis would be a very important thing if we could fix the myelin sheath by adding in-stem cells. Paralysis based on lesions in the spinal cord, stroke, heart attack, AIDS, if we could improve their immune system by giving them stem cells, kidney failure, Alzheimer's disease, and a number of the muscular dystrophies. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease would be another possibility.
Mm-hmm. So the potential is great, but as I forgive me if I'm saying this yet again, as I said, but it's something that's just the research is just starting. So we really don't know how these might develop, how long it would take, so forth.
That's right.
And would we expect that at least in if there are therapies that were developed, at least at the beginning, it also would be the case that they would probably be costly.
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're just about at the point where I think we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. But I'm sure that in other ways, other days, we'll probably manage to find other ways to talk about this and perhaps follow it along as things go along. But we certainly appreciate you being here and giving us some of your time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Our guest this morning, Dr. Robert Cranston. He is a neurologist and bioethicist at Carl Clinic in Urbana.